So we're in chapter 3. Anybody remember what came before that? Chapter 2. Yeah, excellent. And chapter 2 ended with a good news, bad news scenario. The good news was that Naomi and Ruth, in their brokenness, in their isolation, in their poverty, in their loneliness, it looked like they found a provider and a protector, because Boaz has stepped in to be their provider. He stepped in to be their protector. And quite possibly it looked like in chapter 2 that maybe, even though he was not legally obligated, it looked like he was going to step in and be their redeemer as well. But there was also some bad news in chapter 2, because chapter 2 ended without Boaz stepping in as their redeemer. Boaz went silent for 2 months. He gave all this attention to Ruth, but she was left wondering, where's this relationship going? Are you going to be my redeemer or not? Are you going to redeem my mother-in-law, Naomi, or not? Are you going to redeem her family name or not? And they were just left wondering, where's this relationship going? And incidentally, ladies, that is a biblical question to ask. Never let a guy tell you it's not. As Ruth was left wondering, where's this relationship going? We just love hearing that question, too. Just so you know. All men, single men, love it. So they're just left wondering what's going to happen. And today we're going to find out in this good news, bad news scenario. We're going to see what Boaz's intentions are. So if you're not already there, open up to Ruth chapter 3. And here's how we're going to break this text down. In the first 5 verses of Ruth chapter 3, we're going to start to learn how to trust in God's providence, as we see that both Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz were trusting in the providence of God. And because they trusted in the providence of God, you're going to see that they were displaying this radical trust. So if you're trusting in the providence of God, that God has sovereignly decreed the ends, and the providence of God is how God, day by day, moment by moment, choice by choice, He carries out that plan. How He works all things together for good to those that love Him, to those that are called according to His purpose. That's providence. And the more we trust in God's invisible hand, the providence of God guiding our lives, we're going to have this radical trust. And then that's going to move into, starting in verse 6, a courageous loyalty. So once you have this radical trust, you're going to start having courageous loyalty in your life. Then in verses 10 through 18, we'll pick up and we'll see how that results in radical generosity. So here is Naomi and Ruth not knowing what is happening, not knowing what's going to go on. So what does Naomi do? She does what any good mom would do. She tries to fix up her daughter, right? Isn't that what moms do? So you can see her trying to devise a plan. And I don't know, I'm sure in the local Bethlehem Bee, she probably wrote into Dear Abby. You guys remember who Dear Abby is? Whenever you don't know the answer, you write into someone smarter than you, Dear Abby. It was probably Dear Sarah or Dear Deborah in those days. And she probably wrote a letter that sounded a lot like this. Dear Deborah, Dear Sarah, my daughter is a great, great godly woman. She is a worthy woman. Her reputation precedes her everywhere she goes. But we're in a hopeless situation, and we need help. There's a godly man, an older man, a much older man, who's shown interest in her life. He's blessed her. He's cared for her, but he stopped short of telling her where this relationship is going. And we don't know what to do. We don't know if he wants to marry her or if he just wants to be like a grandfather, father figure to her. We're not sure. Can you help us warm his cold feet, so to speak? Can you help us get him moving? Can you help us find out where he stands in this relationship? Signed, meddling mother. Yeah. That's a loving thing to have a meddling mother. If it bothers you that your mother likes to meddle in your life, you should rejoice, because the opposite is your mom doesn't care. And that's not a good thing. So moms love and care for us. So let's see Naomi's plan as she steps out to take a very courageous risk, and as she teaches Ruth how to trust her and how to have a radical risk in her life as she trusts in the providence of God. So look at chapter 3, verse 1. And then Naomi, and we're going to see her plan now. This is the mother's plan. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her. Now, from the beginning of chapter 2, this is 2 months later. So the barley harvest is coming to an end, and they're about to have this celebration. So 2 months of hard labor and work has gone in. God's famine has been lifted. He's now blessing his people once again. Bethlehem, which means the house of bread, is going to have bread once again. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter." You see that? She thinks of Naomi, her daughter-in-law, as her own daughter. This is family. They have covenant relationship because they both love the same God. They both serve the same God. And that is make their family even tighter. So she says, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you?" See how she's now Naomi is seeking the benefit of her daughter. We saw that early on. Naomi was so focused on herself that she was blind to the blessing of Ruth in her life. She was so blind to how God was working in her life and how God was blessing her because she was so focused on herself, because that's what tragedy does. Tragedy and heartache, and she was just bombarded with one relentless onslaught after another in her life of constant tragedy. And she took her eyes off God. She took her eyes off of others. But as soon as God started waking her up with his covenantal love, his hesed, his covenant-making, covenant-keeping love, the love that saves you, brings you into relationship with himself, and that love that keeps you in relationship with herself, with himself, she started waking up to that, and she started seeking the benefits of others. First, it was Boaz. First, she was praying for Boaz, for him to continually be being blessed by God. Now she's put her focus on Naomi. That's why we use that, or on Ruth, and that's why we use that acronym of joy in our lives. If we want joy, we have to put Jesus first. That's what the J stands for. So we put God first. The O stands for others. So we put others before ourselves. And then lastly, the Y is for you. And if you're putting your focus on Jesus and you're putting your focus on others, you're going to have joy. That's God's economy. That's how God works. That's how God blesses and works through his people. And so often putting your focus on others, seeking the benefit of others, is what we need to lift that darkness from our life. It may not remove the tragedy. It may not change the circumstances, but it very much changes your outlook on the circumstances. And you have that biblical joy that is bulletproof. That is just seen shining because you're reflecting the love of your God and pouring it out into everybody around you. So verse 1 says, Naomi said, "Should I not seek rest for you?" Now, rest for you means a husband, okay? She's looking at her daughter-in-law, and she's doing what moms do. "I'm going to fix you up. We're going to find a husband for you." Because remember, the solution is they need rest. And the only way they're going to have rest, the only way they're going to have an inheritance, the only way they're going to have provisions that continue is if Ruth gets married and has a child. Because that's where the inheritance came from in this culture, in this society. So she's very much seeking a husband for her. And she says, "I want to seek rest for you that it may go well for you." And then she adds, look at verse 2, "Is not Boaz our relative?" Is not Boaz possibly going to be our kinsman redeemer? Boaz has already shown some possibility of having a desire to redeem, but now he's kind of stalled. He's done what most guys do. We're not telling you where the relationship's going. So she says, "Is not Boaz our relative with whom the young women you were?" Remember, Boaz said, "You stay with the young women in my family. You stay here and we'll protect you. We'll provide for you. We'll take care of you." So he was praying earlier for her to find the shelter under God's wing, to find refuge there. And Boaz started to provide that shelter for her, started to provide that refuge for her. But he hasn't gone all the way yet. I'll continue in verse 2. She says, "See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." Now, this is important that she's saying the time is urgent. All right, there comes a time in the Christian life for being patient. There comes a time in the Christian life for patiently and quietly waiting for God to work something miraculous, for God to work something beautiful, for God to work something marvelous. But then there comes a time for taking extreme godly risks, right? I think about Mark chapter 2 with the guys. They have a good friend, someone they care for who's paralyzed. And so they have him on a little bed and they're carrying him up to Jesus to be healed. And they can't get in because the crowds are pressed so tight. They can't make their way to Christ for Christ to lay his hand on their friend who they love and care for. So what should they do? Should they continually wait? Should they just patiently wait outside? Maybe Christ will see him when he exits? No, they go to the roof. I love this. They dig a hole in the ceiling, and as Christ is teaching, they lower their dear brother, this man they care about, right as Christ is teaching. They lower him right before him from the roof. Now, sometimes God closes doors, and he wants you to kick them open. That's a prime example. Just because a door is closed doesn't mean God doesn't want you to go through it. And here, this is what Ruth is learning from her mother, who loves God so dearly. There comes a time to take a risk. You see, the barley festival is about to begin. God has brought back food to his people. The famine is over. And now the harvest has come to an end, which means Ruth has had contact with Boaz for 2 months. But this contact is going to end, possibly, for a whole nother year. So if Boaz is going to get moving, if Boaz is going to give his intentions to Ruth, if Ruth is going to find out what Boaz's intentions are towards her, it's now or never, humanly speaking. Because let's face it, Boaz isn't getting any younger, is he? He's a lot older than Ruth is. So she says, see, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. So this is the end. They take all of the fruit of their labor, they take all this barley and they put it down in this spot. So there's a big circle, and they wait for the coolness of the evening to begin when there's this light breeze flowing through. Then they take this big pitchfork and they shove it into the grain or into the harvest, and they throw it up into the air, and all the chaff just starts blowing away. And then the stalks blow a little bit further, but right at their feet falls all the grain. So they gather all this grain, and this year they're having a party to end all parties. They're having a celebration because the famine is over. Look at verse 3. Watch what she says, because she's going to call her daughter-in-law to change the way she's presenting herself to Boaz. She wants her daughter to be attractive. She wants her daughter to be attentive. She wants her daughter to be assertive, and she wants her daughter to be available and to make that known to Boaz. Let me show you from the text. Look at verse 3. She says, wash therefore and anoint yourself and put on your cloak. Some of your translations may say best clothes. Put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. Now, she doesn't have best clothes. The Hebrew word there is cloak. It's this outer garment. Remember, she lives in extreme poverty, right? So she buys all of her clothes at the local Goodwill. So she's looking in her closet. Is she going to get her 90s mom jeans or her 80s acid wash jeans and put them on? I mean, that's her best clothes. I want you to see what Naomi is asking Ruth to do. She says, wash yourself, anoint yourself, put on your cloak. In other words, change the way you're presenting yourself. Let Boaz know that your time of mourning for losing your husband is over. The time of mourning has ended. Matter of fact, in 2 Samuel 12, we should have this text up here for you momentarily. You can see the exact same Hebrew words are used to describe King David. You see, King David had lost his son, and he was in a season of mourning, and he was broken. And I want you to hear how these same words arise here. Verse 20, 2 Samuel 12. Then David arose from the earth, and he washed and anointed himself. So there's the word wash, there's the word anointed, and he changed his clothes. Same word there. He put on this outer cloak, and he went into the house of the Lord, and he worshiped. And then he went into his own house. So you can see King David is announcing to his people that the season of mourning is over. He's going back to his life as usual. And that's what Naomi is telling Ruth. Present yourself. Let Boaz know that you're no longer mourning the death of your husband. Let Boaz know by the way you present yourself to him. And let's keep reading. And she replied, wash yourself, therefore anoint yourself, put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. So he wants you to be attractive, but also attentive. Look at verse 4. But when he lies down, observe to the place where he lies. So it's going to be the end of the evening. It's not the right time to go up and talk to a guy while everyone's celebrating and everybody's around. Hey, where's this relationship going? He's like, I got my boys around me. Come on, just back off just a little bit. You got to wait for the appropriate time. Wait for the celebration to be over. Wait until he's in the best possible mood. Wait till it's a private time so you don't humiliate him, so you don't embarrass him in case he's not interested. So wait to the right time. But be attentive. Make sure you know where he lies down so you can carry out this plan. And I'll keep reading verse 4. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. So now Naomi's telling Ruth to be very assertive, to go and uncover his feet. And we're going to see why she has him do that in just a moment. But I'll give you a hint. It's very risky what Ruth is called to do. It's actually very dangerous what Naomi is calling Ruth to do. But we'll see why she feels safe to have her daughter-in-law, to have someone she thinks of as her own daughter, her own flesh and blood, do something so dangerous, to do something so risky. But we'll hold off. We'll get to that. I also want you to see how she wants Ruth to be available. Look at verse 4. But when he lies down, that's Boaz, this is still Naomi talking, observe the place where he lies, and then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. You starting to see why this is so scary? Right? Go in the middle of the night, go to the threshing floor. Remember how dangerous it was for a woman, especially a foreign woman, to go glean in the daytime? Boaz had to make the very first recorded sexual harassment policy ever recorded in all of history as he commanded his young men not to harass her, to make sure that this woman is protected in the field. So if it's that dangerous in the daytime to glean in the field, how dangerous would it be for a woman at night to go to the threshing floor? You see how risky this is. But Naomi wants her to be assertive and to be available. And watch how she responds. Look at verse 5. And she, that's Ruth, replied, all that you say, I will do. All that you say, I will do. If that's not a radical risk, I've never seen one. But why can Naomi come up with this plan that is so radical, come up with this plan that is so risky? Why can she do that? Number one, because she trusts in the providence of God. She trusts in God. She trusts that whatever God brings, it's what's best. She's learning the tragedy that she went through, the 10 years of suffering that she'd gone through, it wasn't for naught. God was with her through that whole thing, and God was working all things out together for good for her because God loved her, and God loves Ruth because Ruth is now in the covenant as well. So she trusts God's character, and she also trusts Boaz's character. She's had 2 solid months. Not only does Boaz's reputation precede him everywhere he goes, we're going to see that when he goes into the courts, all the elders look at him with respect. He's considered an elder. He has righteous behavior. He's already been called a worthy man. He's been called a man of valor. This is a godly man. And Naomi has had 2 solid months looking at Boaz's character and says, this is a godly man. I can have you do this risky thing because I know a godly man will never take advantage of a godly woman. So she's trusting in God. She's trusting in the observable character of Boaz. And Ruth turns around and says, I'll take this risk because I'm learning to trust in the providence of God. And I'm learning to trust in you, Naomi, who only has my best interest in mind. I'm trusting that. And I trust Boaz because I too have seen his character for the last 2 months. Do you have that type of radical trust where you're willing to take a risk? No matter what the consequences look like, no matter what God allows to enter in, do you trust in God's providence so much and his visible hand in your life that you're willing to risk reputation, you're willing to risk finances, you're willing to risk everything to bring glory to God's name, to show hesed, covenantal faithfulness, covenantal love to those around you? If you trust in the providence of God, you will. And that'll lead into a courageous loyalty. And that's what we see Ruth putting on display. Look at verse 6. So she, that's Ruth, and this is the loyalty you're seeing. She went down to the threshing floor. Remember, not a safe thing to do. She's going at night. This is dangerous. There are men, some of them aren't godly like Boaz, and there's a lot of wine that people are celebrating with. Godly men never get drunk, but ungodly men abuse that gift of wine. So there's intoxicated men in the field. She's taking this risk. So she went down to the threshing floor, and she did just as her mother-in-law had commanded. That is courageous loyalty. Look at verse 7. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, so he's of good spirits. He's celebrating. He's happy. text says, and his heart was merry. Why is he so happy? Because the famine's over. He's celebrating with his people. He's out celebrating and rejoicing with his people. He's displaying what godliness looks like. When God brings a gift, when God brings a blessing, we don't say, look at what we accomplished. We say, look at what God has accomplished for us. We're all about praising God. We're all about celebrating. We're all about rejoicing. We want people to know what our God has done. That's why he spares no expense. That's why he has this grand party, this grand celebration. That's why he's providing the food and the wine for his people. And still, if you own a business, it's good to provide food and wine for your people. I had a buddy, he had a technology company, and he went to hear some latest speaker from, actually this was in Colorado, the speaker was from one of the big tech companies out here, and he says, if you provide food for your people, they'll be happier, and they'll trust you more, and they'll be loyal to you, and they'll stay even if times are lean, even if times are hard. And my buddy was so excited because he started seeing fruit because he was doing this at his work, and he was telling me about it, and I was like, yeah, I know another guy who did the exact same thing. And I was able to take him to this book. Verse 7, and when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. So he's a godly man. He's protecting his property. And he's not just relying on his employees to do it. He's out there too. He's in the midst of it. And he's sleeping because there were... This is the period of the judges. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes, except for the godly men like Boaz. So there are men that would try to go out and steal their work, would try to take what they worked so hard for, would try to take his profits, the very profits that he was sharing with his employees, the very profits that he was giving up freely to the orphans and to the widows and to the foreigners who were traveling through, that he would allow to come in and glean and work. He's protecting his blessing so that he can bless others. That's what godly men and women do. So he's lying down at the foot of the ground. I'll finish verse 7. Then she, that's Ruth, came softly. So you can see him just sneaking in, not wanting to wake anyone up, just sneaking in, or as my daughter would say, like a ninja. She sneaks up on me all the time. It's my fault. I started it. I sneak up on her and scared her too many times. So now she thinks it's funny because I'd laugh so hard. Now she does it to me all the time. She says, Dad, I'm a ninja. And, you know, my heart, I'm probably going to die at 50. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet, and she lay down. Now, this is risky, right? She uncovers his feet. Why? So that his feet will get cold, so he'll wake up, so without being too startled, and he'll look down and see her. But think how risky this is. If Boaz was not a godly man, he could take advantage of her. He could abuse her sexually. He could abuse her sexually, and then he could charge her with prostitution and have her arrested. He could look at her as some lady just trying to climb the social ladder, someone who's coming outside their own level, their own class. She has no business coming to me like this. Her life could be in danger. Her reputation could be in danger. This is a risk that she's doing because she has courageous loyalty, and she's putting it on display. Then she came in softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. And at midnight, the man was startled and turned over. Why? He realized he had cold feet. His feet are uncovered. So he's startled and he turns over and behold, a woman lay at his feet. Now, think how startled you'd be right there. And what do you think he said to her? What would you say? Who are you? Right? Anybody have kids in here? Right. Your kids ever do that? They wake up in the middle of the night, they have a bad dream and they just stand in the doorway. That happened to me. I'm half asleep. And I feel like someone's staring at me. And I kind of open my eyes. Everything's a little blurry. The nightlight from the kids' bathroom shining so I can see a silhouette. And I'm like, who are you? And it's just me, Dad. Oh, okay. So not the same thing that Boaz went through, but somewhat similar. Look at verse 9. He said, who are you? That's an important question that's going to come back again. Who is Ruth? What is so special about Ruth? And he said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. You see her humility. I'm Ruth. I'm your servant. I don't deserve anything. But you've been blessing me. You've been protecting me. You've been providing for me. She says, I am Ruth, your servant. Now she wants to make sure. her intentions are clear. She doesn't want any ambiguity. She wants to make sure he knows she's not there for one night of passion. She's there for a long haul. She's there for relationship. She's there for covenant. She's there for redemption. And she says, spread your wings over your servant, for you are my redeemer. Doesn't that sound exactly like Ruth 2:12? Where Boaz was praying and he says, I pray that God does this for you. I pray that God spreads his wings over you. I pray that you find shelter in his refuge. That was Boaz's prayer. And who is God using to answer Boaz's own prayer? Boaz. It's like that for us. So many times we're praying for someone. God, I know they're struggling. Please help them, Lord. It's your job. God's put them on your heart so that you can help them. It'd be like, we talked about this before, it'd be like a dad at night praying with his kids, and they're sitting around praying together, and all of a sudden the dad goes, Lord, please send someone to hug my kids tomorrow. And your kids be like, Dad, that's why God gave us you. Right? So often, God calls us to answer the very prayers in his strength that we're asking him. Are you available? Do you have that kind of courageous loyalty to sacrifice so that you can bless others? In verse 9, he said, Who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over me, for you are my redeemer. Her intentions could not be clearer. She's not proposing to him, but she's coming pretty close. Any guys in here ever been proposed to? Right. None? It looked like, was that Micah who raised his hand? I couldn't tell. One of the young men just raised their hand. I couldn't tell which one it was. She's not proposing to Boaz, but she's coming pretty close. She's actually proposing for Boaz to propose. That's what she's doing, I guess would be the technical way to say that. And watch what he says. And this is where we're going to see what gracious generosity looks like. We've seen what radical risk looks like. We've seen what courageous loyalty looks like. Now we're going to see what gracious generosity looks like. Watch how this godly man, this man of valor, this worthy man, watch how he answers her. Look at verse 10. And he, that's Boaz, said, May you be blessed by the Lord. That's a godly man. That's what godly people do. They're looking out for the best interests of others. Ladies, if you're single and you've been having interest shown by a guy and he's always talking about himself, he's always talking about his job, he's always talking about what he wants to do, and he's never talking about you, and he's never asking God to bless you, and God never comes into the conversation, or you got to be around him for hours upon hours, sometimes days before you even hear God brought into the conversation, you know that guy's not for you yet. You know he's not spiritually mature enough to be a redeemer, to be a husband. So distance yourself from those men until God changes them, until God brings them along. This is a godly man. Verse 10, he says, May you be blessed by the Lord. So he's bringing God into this relationship. He wants to make sure she knows God is the center, and he asks for God to bless her. He says, May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter, still showing dignity. Still showing respect. She's trusting in Naomi's assessment of Boaz's character. She's trusting in her own assessment of his character. But let's face it, he could have still acted outside of his character. He still could have taken advantage of her. And he's letting her know, I have nothing but the utmost respect for you. He says, my daughter. That's how an older man would talk to a woman who is younger than him, who's not his wife. So he says, don't worry, my daughter. You have made this last kindness, and there's that word hesed again, that covenantal love, that covenantal faithfulness. Once you experience God's covenant-making, covenant-keeping love, the love that saves you and the love that keeps you in relationship with God, you're now obligated to pour it out into the lives around you. God doesn't bless you because you're great. God doesn't bless you because you're so wonderful. He blesses you so you can be a blessing to others. That's what hesed is. That's what covenantal love is. That's what steadfast love is. That's what loyalty is. That's what faithfulness is all about. And he says, you made this last kindness greater than your first. The first kindness is how Ruth loved Naomi. how Ruth sacrificed everything to make sure her mother-in-law, who was destitute, who had no hope, who changed her name to Mara. She says, don't call me sweetheart. Don't call me pleasant one, because that's what Naomi means. Call me bitter. That was a woman who did not need a rebuke. That was a woman who needed a Ruth. She needed love. She needed to see covenantal love on display towards her. That's the first kindness, Boaz said. And he says, now what you're doing is even greater than that. And here's why. He says, because you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. Right? What Ruth needs is a child. Boaz is an older man. The chances of them having a child together is another risk. But if she was to go after a younger man, she could get a child for sure. Do you see the kindness that she's showing? Do you see what covenantal love looks like? When you've been changed by God's love, your perception of a mate, your perception of a spouse, your perception of what godliness looks like, of what attractiveness looks like is totally different. Right? Before you're saved, it's all about looks. It's all about hobbies. It's all about what can this person do to add to my life? Because I need a person to come into my life to improve me. It's almost like a self-help project for yourself. But when you've been changed by God's radical covenant-making, covenant-keeping love, the standard of beauty is different. The standard of beauty is godliness. When a man sees a godly woman, a woman who sacrifices for the glory of God, a woman that puts others first, he just wants to do the exact same thing in her life. That's true beauty. That's true attractiveness. That's why he says this is an even greater gift. Look at verse 11. And he says, and now my daughter. In other words, I don't need time to think about this. If you're a young man, you've got a godly woman like this coming into your life, and she says, you know, it's time to progress this relationship. I need to know where we stand. I need to know if we're heading anywhere. I need to know if a ring's in the future. And she's a godly woman. You don't need too much time to think about that. You don't need to get your bros together and say, should I or shouldn't I? No, you know. Because you don't ever want to let a godly woman slip through your fingers. You'll regret it for the rest of your life. And he says, and now my daughter, do not fear. He wants to comfort her. He's setting her ease. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know, and get this, look at this word, that you are a worthy woman. Once again, her reputation precedes her. He says, you're a worthy woman. How is Boaz described? As a worthy man, a man of worth, a man of valor, a godly man. And now Ruth is described as a worthy woman. What is that? That's what equally yoked looks like. That's what it means when you marry someone who's equally yoked. You see, that's why Paul says in 2 Corinthians 7 that it's a sin to for a believer to marry a non-believer because you're not equally yoked. Your lives don't mesh. You can never truly be one flesh because your centers are different. And that even goes beyond just testimony. You can have a strong believer and a nominal believer, possibly a make-believer, someone who just professes faith, but you don't believe the same things about Christ. You're not committed to Christ in the same way. You would not be equally yoked. You see, because what happens when you have one Christian person who's tasted God's chesed, who understands what covenantal loyalty is, what sacrifice is, you just want to put the other first. You want to do everything for them. You sacrifice your identity. You sacrifice yourself for them because that's what love does. Biblical love always sacrifices. And if you're not equally yoked, what's going to happen? The other person is going to take advantage of you. And you're going to be a doormat for the rest of your life. But if it's two people who are equally yoked, who have been changed by God's covenantal love, his covenant-making, covenant-keeping, that radical one-way love, and it's changed them, it's gripped them, it's charmed them, it's entertained them, it's transformed them, you're not going to have one person taking advantage of the other. You're going to have those beautiful Christian arguments that I just love so much. What do you want to do tonight? I want to do what you want to do, sweetie. Well, I only want to do what you want to do. And it goes on for like 20 minutes because you're both putting the interest of the other above. And then you don't go anywhere and you stay home and, hey, you save some money. So it's not a bad deal. So that's what's going on here. But there's something else when you look back at what he called her. He said, are you not a worthy woman? You see that in verse 11? Turn over to Proverbs 31 because I want you to see this. Now, in the Protestant Bible, we have our books in the Old Testament in a different order than the Hebrew Bible. And it makes sense to put the book of Ruth right after the book of Judges because Ruth takes place in the period of the Judges. But you want to know where the book of Ruth is in the Hebrew Bible? Right after Proverbs 31. What is Proverbs 31 all about? Well, go to Proverbs 31:10. I want to show you because the first five verses, you have a king saying, this is the kind of woman you need to look for. This is the kind of woman you need to marry. This is what a worthy woman looks like. This is what a godly woman looks like. And it's a hardworking woman. It's a woman who has a job. She's out in the marketplace. She's out selling real estate. She's taking care of her family. She's up before the sun. She's working in the mid until late at night. That's godliness. You notice how godly men and godly women's character look identical? They're partners in life. And in verse 10 of Proverbs 31, we have the exact same Hebrew words that are used by Boaz and by how the people in the town talk about Ruth. Verse 10 says, an excellent wife who can find, she is more precious than jewels. That word excellent wife can also be translated a worthy woman. A worthy woman. So what is Ruth? Ruth is a worthy woman. Ruth is an excellent wife. Ruth is a Proverbs 31 woman. So you're reading Proverbs 31 and you're like, there's no one like that. Turn the page, there's Ruth. Men, if you're single, that's the kind of woman you're looking for. You want this type of Proverbs 31 woman. So let's see what happens next. Look at verse 12. And now it is true that I am a redeemer. This is what Boaz says. I am a redeemer. He says, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. So now we find out why Boaz went silent for 2 months. Now we find out why Boaz didn't progress this relationship, because he's a godly man and he never wants to step in front of another godly man. So he wants to give this other man to see if he is righteous, to see if he does go beyond the letter of the law and go all the way to grace like Boaz does. And he wants to give that man a chance to act like a godly man. You see, sometimes we don't think of young men as godly men yet because we protect them so much from making decisions. We make all their decisions for them. Parents, let your young men fail. Let them succeed, but let them do it on their own terms so that you can work with them through the choices that they make. The only way they're going to become godly men and start making godly decisions is if you push them, is if you let them fall sometimes, if you let them fail. So Boaz is giving this man a chance to fail. So now you know why he's persisted. Verse 13, he says, remain tonight and in the morning. So he wants her to be safe. Godly men always look out for the safety of women. He says, remain tonight in the morning. If he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. And then he says, lie down until morning, again, looking out for safety. But he says, I will redeem you. Now, remember, we talked about this. He says, I'm willing to be a redeemer, even though he's not biblically obligated to do it. Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10, this is so cool. It actually sets up who is legally obligated to be a kinsman redeemer. It has to be the brother of the man who died. Problem is, Mahlon's brother, Chilion, died. So there's no brother to step in and marry Ruth so that the family line, which came through Elimelech, who also died, can be carried on. So they lose everything. They lose their land. They lose their inheritance. Everything is gone as soon as Naomi dies. So Boaz doesn't have to be a redeemer. Matter of fact, if he did have to be a redeemer, she wouldn't have to go through all this. All a woman had to do was walk into the courts in front of the elders while that man was present and say, will you redeem me? And I love this. Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10 sets up what happens if he doesn't want to be a godly man. She's to steal his sandal. They're always taking sandals off in the Old Testament. It would be a horrible time for me because I don't like feet that much. And sandals and dust in the desert, They don't go well together, but they're always stealing sandals from people. We'll see that in the next chapter too. She used to take his sandal and then spit on him. Okay? Bringing shame on his name. He's never going to be looked upon as a righteous man ever again. But Boaz doesn't have to do that. She has no legal right for him to be a redeemer, yet he says, I'll do it. Why? Because godliness goes beyond the letter of the law, goes all the way to grace. Who does Boaz sound like once again? Look at verse 14. So she laid his feet until morning. Now, how much sleeping do you think was going on? Right? Is he going to redeem me? Boaz is going, oh, I hope this guy doesn't step up because I really want to marry her. She's such a godly woman. I doubt very little sleeping went on there. But we know what didn't go on there. Sadly, there are some liberal commentators who say when Boaz bent down, that sexual relationships took place. The story will not allow you to go there because their character is what's on display. And godly men and godly women will not do that before they're married. That is a gift. It's one of the greatest gifts in marriage, but it's only for marriage. So we know that isn't what happened. And then sadly, some conservative commentators go, you know, there's really no emotion going on here. This is just a legal contract Ruth's trying to set up with Boaz. No, the text makes it clear. They have affection towards each other. They look at each other differently. They look at their worthiness, their righteousness. They look at their holiness, and they're attracted to one another. So there is a very real emotion going on here. So I think I know what was going on that night. A whole lot of praying. Because could you sleep during that? What's going to happen? I have no idea. So verse 14, so she laid his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. He's already looked out for her safety. Don't go back at night. Something could happen to you. Now he was protecting her reputation. Don't let anybody know that you were out here. I don't want anybody to start to think negatively of you. You have a reputation. I'm a godly man. I'm going to guard your reputation at all costs. Look at verse 15. And he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. That's the cloak she put on herself. So she held it out and measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. And then she went into the city. So it's kind of giving her cover, right? So what are you doing out this time? Well, I've got all this barley with me. But it goes deeper. He put out 6 measures of barley. So she's got 6 you wonder how much this would weigh? This is like 80 pounds. So he puts this cloak, fills it up with 80 pounds of seed, and then puts it on her back. And when the Bible uses numbers, it uses numbers both literally and also figuratively, because numbers point to something greater. And it's very significant that the primary author of this book used the number 6, the Holy Spirit. He brought the writer, the prophet who wrote this, carried him along to write these words, and he superintended, providentially led Boaz to actually put this 6 measures there, because 6 is the number of incompleteness. You see, Boaz has given her 6 measures of seed, because what she really needs is a seed. She really needs a child. But what he's offering her is not complete yet. Just like God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, but it was incomplete. Creation was not complete until the 7th day when God rested. How did this chapter begin? Naomi wants Ruth to have rest. How is she going to have rest if she gets a husband and has a child? Yet the gift he's offering her is incomplete. So now she's left sitting in that incompleteness, wondering, am I going to have rest? Is there rest for me? And incidentally, the story of redemption progresses and points to that final rest. It's the rest we have when we repent of our sin and put our faith and trust in Jesus. We enter into the rest that the land always pointed to. The land was never truly the rest. Jesus is the rest. And the author of Hebrews says there's yet a final rest we're waiting for. When that promised seed through the Abrahamic covenant, Jesus returns on his second advent. So we're sitting in our incompleteness waiting for our final rest when Jesus returns as well. Let's keep reading and we'll wrap this up. Look at verse 16. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare? Now, That's a little misleading. That's not actually what the Hebrew says. What the Hebrew text says, and you know why the English translations did this, so the story makes more sense to us as we're reading it. What she actually says is, who are you? Now, this isn't who are you like Boaz, who's waking up in the middle of the night after partying all night, having fun, not getting drunk, but enjoying the festival and celebrating and being in dead sleep, waking up, someone standing, who are you? No, Naomi's not saying, who are you that way? She says, who are you, my daughter? And that's the question of the book. Who is Naomi? Who is Ruth? Who is Boaz? And specifically right now, who is Ruth? The text keeps saying she's a Moabite woman. She's a woman from the wrong side of the track. She's a woman from the wrong family. She's a woman that no one in Israel would normally accept. Who is she? Is she engaged? Is she single? Does she have hope? Does she not have hope? Is she going to find rest? Is she not going to find rest? Do you see how significant that question is? Who are you, my daughter? And then she says, then she, that's Ruth, told her, Naomi, all that the man had done for her. Verse 17, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me. Now, who did he give those 6 measures to? Who was it really for? Naomi. Single men take care of the mothers. I'm just saying, it'll go better for you if you do. They might actually try to make your daughter marry you. These 6 measures of barley, we need all the help we can get, let's be honest, guys. Aren't the women so much godlier in churches now than the men? Yeah? So we need so much help. I remember when I was saved and I had the desire to find a godly wife, and I asked for advice. How do I find a godly wife? The pastor said, well, you just run after Jesus as fast as you can. When you get to a place where you're feeling confident, you're feeling good in your walk with Christ, look to your left, look to your right, and whoever's there, that's who you marry. So I ran as hard and fast as I could, and then I looked to my left, no one was there. I looked to my right, no one was there. I'm like, is this the gift of celibacy? I don't want it. Can I return it? And then I looked up and I saw my wife about 200 yards ahead of me. So I sprinted to catch up with her. So we need all the help we can get, guys. I'm just saying. So these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Now look at verse 18. She replied, wait, my daughter. Right? Wait. There's a time to take risk. There's a time to kick in those closed doors. And there's a time to wait. Biblical wisdom knows the difference. The more you saturate yourself in God's word, the more familiarity you have with your God, the more you're going to be attuned when it's time to risk and when it's time to wait. That's why if you're young in the faith, whether young in the age or just young in the faith, look for counsel from godly men and women who have been walking with the Lord a lot longer than you. That's why we don't want our gospel communities, too many of them, separated by age. We want all different generations in our gospel community. Because young people, you need the wisdom of the older people, right? Of the seniors. Older people, we need the wisdom, or we need the energy of the younger people, actually. That's what we need. We need their energy. We need to see their drive and determination so that we don't get complacent and lazy, right? So we need each other. And now she's getting counsel to wait. She says, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. She's still trusting in her evaluation of Boaz's righteousness. But I want you to see these 3 people, Naomi, Ruth, Boaz, all of them for love, for hesed, willing to make themselves vulnerable. C.S. Lewis says, because we're all scared of being vulnerable. What if they reject me? What if they take advantage of me? C.S. Lewis says, you can't truly love until you've made yourself vulnerable. And the only way to not be vulnerable is to be in hell. Right? That's the only way you can escape love. True love will always make you vulnerable. And all 3 of these people are not just trying to bless one another. All 3 of these people are committed to one another. You want to know the difference between invested in someone and being committed to someone? It's the conversation the hog had with the chicken about breakfast. And they're arguing about who's more committed to breakfast. Well, the chicken said, I'm invested, right? I gave an egg. Well, the hog says, I'm committed. I gave myself, right? That's why bacon tastes better than eggs. I'm just saying. All 3 of these people are committed to each other. Naomi giving her life to Ruth. Ruth giving her life to Naomi and to Boaz. Boaz giving his life to Naomi and to Ruth. That's biblical commitment. These are three people willing to risk. And that's the question I want to leave you with. What are you willing to risk in your life? Right? I see everyday people risk for the strangest things. I had a buddy in Colorado. We lived at 8,000 elevation. It was really stupid. I don't know why I ever lived at 8,000 elevation. People were great. 8,000 elevation, not fun. I couldn't breathe. So we're at 8,000 elevation. He'd go higher and he'd wait for the mountain caps to turn into ice and then he'd go ice climbing. I'm like, what are you doing? Why would you climb a frozen mountain? He says, I like the feeling, the exhilaration. So you're willing to risk your life for an emotion. Right? I've seen men risk their marriages for the delight of one night. I've seen moms and dad risk the godliness of their children by working 10 to 15 hours a day and allowing someone else to raise their kids to make sure their kids are trusting in the Lord just for a bigger paycheck, just for a bigger house, for a third and a fourth car. I've seen people risk their reputation to save a little bit of money on their taxes. I see people risk every single day. But what are we willing to risk for holiness? What are we willing to risk for righteousness? It's like Francis Schaeffer said. He said, the secret little sin of most Christians is we're not willing to risk anything for the gospel. We don't want to risk our reputation at work. What if we don't get the next promotion? We don't want to risk our reputation with our friends. What if they think we're simpletons? We don't want to risk our comfortable life because what if the government takes something from us? What are we willing to risk for the gospel? You see, the more we understand God's providence, that nothing happens outside His decree, that everything that takes place in our life is His invisible hand carrying us and conforming us and transforming us from one degree of glory to another so that we look more and more like His Son, Jesus Christ, whom He said, this is my beloved in whom I'm well pleased, which means the more and more we look like Him as we're clothed in His righteousness, clothed in His good works, the Father looks at us and says, in you, I am well pleased. You see, just for the record, I do believe in salvation by works. You didn't know that about me, do you? It's just not your work. It's Jesus' work. That's what's credited to our account. What are you willing to risk for Him? The more you understand His providence in your life, that nothing happens to you outside His hand to make you more like His Son, the more you'll take risks for the gospel. So the more you get this love story, it looks like a love story between Ruth and Boaz. Isn't that a beautiful story? Could you imagine them trying to cast this for a movie? Like, how would they cast Ruth, right? I mean, she can carry 80 pounds of grain on her back in the middle of the night and travel for miles. They can't cast a supermodel to do that. She'd break in two. Who are they going to cast to be Boaz? You can't get Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise or whoever the young people are today. I don't know any of the young actors. You got to make Anthony Hopkins in a love story? That's just not right. But I want you to realize that's not the real love story. The real love story isn't Ruth and Boaz. It's whom Ruth and Boaz are pointing to. It's who comes through the lineage of that love story. And this is the greatest love story ever told. It's the love story of God the Father sending God the Son into His world that He created that rejected Him. And it's God the Son setting aside His glory, veiling His glory, setting aside His divine privileges, adding a very real human nature to Himself, living the life you couldn't live. Every time you said yes to sin, He said no. Every time you said no to God, I won't obey, He said, yes, Father, I will obey. It's God the Son, like Boaz, going beyond the letter of the law and going all the way to grace for you. It's the story of your true Redeemer. As Spurgeon said, it's the story of your true Boaz. His name is Jesus Christ. And if you know Him, trust in His hand in your life. Everything happening to you now, it's for your good. He works all things out together for good towards you because you love Him. And if you don't know that Jesus, I introduce you to Him today. Today is the day you find your Redeemer. Don't leave today without making sure you know Jesus is your Redeemer. I'm here to talk with you afterwards. Pastor Ed's here to talk with you afterwards. Pastor Vincent's here to talk with you afterwards. You know what? We have a board meeting today. So if you talk with me, I don't have to go. So please grab me. We can go old school Baptist and you can give your life to the Lord again for the ninth time. I'll talk with you on that as well. So family, is he your Redeemer? That's how I want to leave it today. Is he your Redeemer? Let's pray.